Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page, and I'd like to introduce my guest co-host. You've met him before, Dr. Bob Gwyther, who's filling in for Adam today. Thanks for being with us, Bob.
Great to be here.
On our show today, Bob and I get to talk with Dr. Julie Byerly, Vice Dean for Education at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill School of Medicine, about training physicians for the 21st century. There's just been a lot of exciting change in medical training and a lot of thought that's put into what we need to do to train doctors for the future. And I'm just delighted, Bob, that we'll have a chance to talk with Dr. Byerly.
I am too. I've known her for years, and she's just a wonderful administrator over there. But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters. We're going to talk about the fact that the minority burden of disease may not be so disproportionate as everybody's always thought. Antidepressant use in pregnancy, antibiotic use in children, and the Zika virus that seems to be spreading so much faster than in previous years.
I know. Well, let's talk first about minorities and risk of heart disease. So we've known, and Adam and I'm sure we've talked with you too, Bob, many times on the show, about some racial and ethnic differences in diabetes, in heart disease risk factors, and in outcomes of patients that tend to not be as positive of outcomes for minorities compared with the rest to the population. And some of these disparities in healthcare are alarming and disturbing. And this is a study really looking at 10 years to look at the true risk, if you can control some other factors, in heart disease among different populations.
And interestingly, this, which is, comes out, is published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, and it was done by a fellow named Jamal Rana, who's the director of Division of Research at Kaiser Permanente in Northern California. They've published before and said that their outcomes in the Medicare population served by Kaiser had almost no differences between incidence of cardiac disease in their population, which they think speaks well for their population. And they found another good finding, and they're sort of broadcasting that now. Essentially, what they did was to measure risk of disease, not actual incidence of disease, but the risk of developing it. And over the 1.3 million Kaiser Permanente employees that are out there, they measured they had very large populations of all different races, 64% white, 14% Asian, 13% Latino, 9% Black. And what they found was that whites actually had a higher burden of disease if they were people who didn't have one of those chronic diseases in the first place or had had no cardiac problems. That group of all of them showed that Latinos, Asians, and African Americans had a lower incidence – I'm sorry, a lower risk of disease than the whites.
So, I mean, in some ways, it's surprising that the risk was lower among Blacks, Latinos, and Asians to develop – heart disease compared to whites. And then, you know, this is one other piece of the puzzle of why are there these disparities in outcomes of patients with ethnic and racial diversities? Is it all about access to care? Are there other, I mean, this is complicated, Bob, but this is, I think it's encouraging both that we're putting some financial resources and people are actually looking in some of these differences to try to understand why there are these health disparities, especially in this case, that their risk is lower. Well, let's talk about antidepressants during pregnancy. So, I mean, as I remember, it's been about the last decade that some research came out showing this association between certain antidepressants and a slightly higher risk of certain heart defects, especially if women were taking that in the third trimester. Now, this didn't all add up for us. Most of the heart is formed in the first trimester. But it's led us over the years to be judicious about the use of antidepressants during pregnancy and just really thoughtful in counseling patients and really weighing out the risk of being more depressed and some of the bad things that can happen from that, not to mention the suffering of the mother and these potential associations, and trying to choose medications that have the lowest risk and informing our patients wisely. So this is a study really looking at a larger set of data to try to see if those risks are real.
And this study is a very big study because it ran for 21 years with over 200,000 pairs of women and children to follow multiple factors for the influence of depression on outcomes in babies. In part to answer this question about other cardiac defects, which 10 years ago people thought was associated with paroxetine or Paxil. But they also had a look at other things such as maternal age, maternal weight, presence or absence of diabetes, alcohol, and illicit drug problems. And importantly, what they discovered was that there is no real difference in the percentage of babies born with heart defects if they use SSRIs or the kind of antidepressant that paroxetine is. And that hopefully cause for joy. They also found that other problems in pregnancy, drug use, alcohol use, does cause these problems and is up to 10 times more common than women who don't have those problems. And I guess the other big point to say here is that 70% of women who stop antidepressants actually relapse during pregnancy, and that can have bad outcomes. And so all of this is to help people counsel their pregnant women on whether to continue antidepressants and clean up their problem if they've got a problem with drugs or alcohol.
Yeah, I think it's good news that this adds to that ongoing debate on whether these medications cause any heart defects, that they've found no evidence to such an effect, and can give, I think, us a little bit more guidance for our patients on the safety of such medications as we're weighing out complex issues of depression and making sure that we are caring fully for our patients and for ourselves, not just with medication, but also with counseling. And it allows us to really think and support women, not just through medication, but also through a more comprehensive approach. And I feel proud of that, and hope that if you are out there and you're having depression and you're pregnant, or someone that you know or love is having some of those symptoms, that you would encourage them to speak with their doctor, because we can help. All right, let's do our next research that matters.
So we've been hearing a lot this week about the so-called Zika virus. This is a virus that got discovered in 1942 and has been very low incidence, very low problems that anybody really knew about until recently, when in Brazil, a group of children with brain defect and a skull defect called microcephaly seemed to start to happen in association with exposure to Zika virus when they were in utero.
So this isn't, you know, groundbreaking research. This is more a letter to the Journal of the American Medical Association talking about the need for organized action, really for the World Health Organization to get together to convene a committee to both catalyze, to accelerate international attention, funding, research, to really organize our efforts to our approach to this virus and make sure that we make rapid gains on protecting the most people. It's exciting to me. We talked with Jillian Steelfisher recently, and we've also done previous shows related to preparing for epidemics and pandemics in our country and in our world. And this is exciting to me to hear the energy around learning from those previous experiences and getting ahead.
And these two experts, Dr. Daniel Lucy and Lawrence Gostin, had written their opinion that we ought to get the WHO on board with the preventive task force in the United States and its counterpart in South America to try to figure out what to do about this. And they were encouraging the consideration of forming a so-called public health emergency of international concern committee to have a look at it. And
I know the committee already met, and that is exciting that we are making forward progress, and exciting that we can respond to these types of crises quickly and efficiently and with the kind of resources that are needed. Let's talk next about antibiotic use in early life. So this is another complicated issue, Bob. We've talked about many times on the show, is antibiotic use in children. So we went through that whole era where everybody wanted an antibiotic for everything. And now where we are realizing that there are both side effects from antibiotics and also this emergence of superbugs and certain bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics because we've used them so liberally over time. This is looking at gut flora. And the word, when we talk about gut flora, we're talking about normal bacteria that kind of live in everybody's body. And in the gut, we're talking about the GI tract. And those bacteria are part of how our bodies work and are important. And when you wipe them out with antibiotics, there can be both side effects like diarrhea and belly pain, but also other potential changes in the body and in health. So this is a study starting to look at these things.
And it was done by a professor, Willem de Vos, from the University of Helsinki, and it had 142 Finnish children ages 2 to 7. And what they showed is that if one uses antibiotics, it alters the gut flora, and it can take a long time, up to a year, to recover if the child only got one course of antibiotics, and it could be several years if they've had multiple courses of antibiotics.
So they were looking at how many courses of antibiotics these children, these 142 children, had received in their lifetime, and then how the use of the antibiotics reflected in their intestinal gut flora, as we're talking about.
And they were looking specifically at weight gain and asthma as two things that can be infected by altering the gut flora. And they came up with a set of recommendations that say penicillin doesn't seem to cause it as much as the macrolides. That's things like azithromycin and erythromycin. So they say don't use those drugs in children unless there's a specific reason to do it. Don't use any antibiotics for what's going to be self-limited or viral disease. And we can probably avoid problems in kids.
We ought to do a whole show just on the use of antibiotics and unnecessary use of antibiotics. It's been a while since we've covered that topic. But these are important topics that we've had a chance to talk about today, Bob. And I appreciate you being with me to talk about the Research Matters portion of the show. We are going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Julie Byerly, Vice Dean for Education at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Medicine, about training physicians for the 21st century. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and our guest host, Dr. Bob Gwyther. Today on Conversations, we will be talking with Dr. Julie Byerly, Vice Dean for Education at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Medicine, talking about training physicians for the 21st century. We are just delighted to have you with us, Dr. Byerly.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, wonder if you would jump in by telling us how you found your way to medical education and how teaching medical students and doctors in training became your true passion.
It certainly is my passion. When I was a college student, my passion was secondary education. And in college, I got a teaching certificate and taught in the classroom for my student teaching and then after college.
Where did you teach?
I taught science in North Charleston, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And that was a fabulous experience, but I found myself more interested in my adolescence, the health problems of the students I was teaching, mm-hmm. than in the material I was actually teaching, how many electrons went around which particular nucleus and that kind of thing. And so through that shift in my interest, I ended up in medical school. But during medical school, I found that medical education allowed me to tie together my interest in teaching and learning and my interest in the health and development of adolescents. So I pursued a pediatrics residency and then became a teacher.
And you've been teaching medical students, residents, and lots of learners in your time since you've been the executive dean, too.
Sure. It's been a great privilege to be a teacher of students at all levels in medicine. You know, the road to becoming a physician is a long road. Students, after graduating from college, pursue medical school. That's about 4 years, typically. And then train in residencies that are at least 3 years duration, typically. So we have a long time to get to know our learners in medicine.
Now, since becoming Vice Dean for Education at UNC, you have led a major overhaul of the curriculum for the medical school with some risk and really stepping out there in innovation for medical education. Tell us a little bit about what that experience was like for you as a new leader in that role and what the vision was and is.
Well, certainly, you know well that healthcare is changing dramatically. And as we prepare physicians to serve in this new healthcare environment, we have to change what we're doing in medical education. So the way was paved nicely by the School of Medicine community at UNC. The faculty, staff, and students were invited to participate in a strategic planning process. And the number one priority in education of the School of Medicine strategic plan that was published in 2012 was to develop a modern curriculum to prepare physicians for North Carolina and beyond to be effective in this new way. So when I came into the role of Vice Dean for Education, that was my charge to revise our curriculum, modernize it. And we had a fabulous opportunity to engage lots of faculty, students, and staff about how to do that best.
So I know that the new curriculum is going to enable more flexibility in medical education. I'm interested in what you might have to say about that. And then also, is it possible that it can also increase the humanistic behaviors of the physicians caring for patients?
Absolutely. And you know this well, of course, Bob, but there is more to learn in medicine than can be learned by a single individual. Fortunately, the resources we have available through the use of technology and so forth make it so students don't have to memorize like they did. But what we have to do is teach physicians of the future how to gain the information that they need and how to utilize that information. So we can now in medicine spend a lot more time thinking about how to communicate effectively, how to work in interprofessional teams, how to gather information instantaneously, and then use that information the way that it's meant to be used in the care of single patients and in populations.
This tech curriculum or translational education at Carolina, it's always hard for me to get that out, but the tech curriculum, part of what you're also thinking about, as you alluded, is the future of healthcare and how much we need to be empowering and enabling our medical students to be agents of change, to be able to improve quality and healthcare delivery in our nation and particularly in our state. How have you approached that big charge with this new curriculum?
Well, one facet in our new curriculum that we are excited about is the leadership development part of our curriculum. We built our curriculum, translational education at Carolina, on a variety of principles that will outline what we are hoping today's medical students will become as physicians. And one of those principles is that we hope to promote the development of leadership skills, professionalism, ethics, humanism, and service to others. And to build our leadership curriculum, we have the opportunity to participate in a national consortium that is addressing change in medical education. This consortium is sponsored by the American Medical Association. We're thrilled to be a part of that.
So, I mean, we have one of the leading medical schools in the nation, one of the top schools. I can say that because I went to medical school at Carolina.
Yes, we're proud of you as an alum, for sure.
Thank you so much. But how does that work to be part of a consortium, and what value does that bring to our state? I can think of a lot of things, but being a part, just thinking about a national consortium, what does that actually mean that you, together with other medical schools, are working towards?
Sure. So we're fortunate to be a part of 31 medical schools in the country who are sponsored by the AMA, the American Medical Association, to investigate change and implement change that is effective in improving the physicians of the future. East Carolina University is also in that consortium, and they have led the way in quality improvement curricula, and we have learned lots from them that we are implementing in our new curriculum as well. But the piece that we're focusing on in the national consortium work is developing physician leaders.
And how will you measure that? I mean, I know you're thinking, sorry, Bob, I know you have lots of questions to you, but I'm getting all excited. And thinking about investing in these leaders, it's a long time for you to really see how you measure the effect of the curricular change, both in leadership and in all the different areas of the curriculum. But how are you approaching that piece?
Well, one thing that we want to do at Carolina is to produce the physicians that North Carolina needs. And one way that we hope to do that is make sure our students early on in their education recognize the needs of the population. Our state needs more primary care providers. Our state needs more general surgeons and more psychiatrists. And we actually need some pediatric subspecialists as well. We want our medical students to recognize those needs, and then we want to help prepare them to fulfill those needs.
I understand that you and Christy have cooked up a specific program with a sexy first name like FIRST to try to both find more people working in primary care in rural areas and also to shorten the onerous time of getting to be the licensed physician out there.
That's correct. So we're really excited about this new pilot project. Christy, Dr. Page, is the director of this program. It's called Fully Integrated Readiness for Service Training. And it is a small pilot program to allow our most focused students on a career in family medicine in service to the underserved needs of our state to graduate medical school in 3 years instead of four and track directly into residency. Christy, I'm sure you'd like to describe more about that program.
Well, we do know that there are multiple states, more than six states, who are using these sorts of accelerated programs to address their state's workforce needs. But the unique part about the FIRST program, well, one is it's the first in our state to do this in this way. But we're able to take those right students and accelerate and enhance their training focused in primary care of the underserved, attach them to train in our residency program at UNC in family medicine with a focus on care of the underserved, but then also tie this with 3 years of service to vulnerable populations in our state. And we have had so much statewide support from multiple entities. This thing is funded by the Duke Endowment. We're very grateful for that. And we're in partnership with the North Carolina Office of Rural Health and Community Care, with North Carolina AHEC, UNC Physicians Network, Piedmont Health Services. We can just keep going on at people who've really stepped up to be a part of the solution to our workforce needs of the state. So I'm grateful that we're embarking on this together, Julie.
Yes, it's very exciting, and it's a model of how we have to be creative to produce the physicians that we need.
Well, we do need to take a short break, but when we return, we will continue talking with our guest, Dr. Julie Byerly, Vice Dean for Education at the UNC School of Medicine, about training the physicians for the 21st century. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and our co-host, Dr. Bob Gwyther. We've been talking with Dr. Julie Byerly, Vice Dean for Education at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Medicine, about training the physicians for the 21st century. And before the break, Dr. Byerly, you were telling us a little bit about the new curriculum that you've really led at UNC, and also about beginning to talk about some of the programs that you have at the School of Medicine, focusing on service in our state. We talked a little bit about a partnership that we are undergoing, funded by the Duke Endowment, called the FIRST Program, or Fully Integrated Readiness for Service Training. It's a mouthful, but the FIRST Program to accelerate and train the right students for underserved primary care in North Carolina. But that's just one of many partnerships and programs that you have going. Tell us a little bit, or give us a little lay of the land of the kind of groups that have stepped up in partnership to help contribute to our state.
Certainly, it's well recognized that in North Carolina, we need physicians to serve rural areas. And we've been fortunate to have the Kenan Charitable Trust get interested in this problem. And the Kenans have helped us develop the Kenan Primary Care Medical Scholars Program. This is a great program that identifies students at the end of their first year of medical school, provides them with scholarship dollars and a cohort of other students interested in serving in rural areas. And then we educate them clinically at our regional campus in Asheville, where they tend to see a more rural patient population. And the Kenans have been very generous with those scholarship dollars such that if the students continue to serve in high-need fields in rural areas in their residencies, they will continue to receive additional scholarship dollars during residency, which is fabulous.
That's fantastic. And, I mean, at least the first students who've gone through that program have been very successful, and the feedback has been tremendous.
That's right. This year, the first class is graduating, and they all are interested in entering needed fields with an intent to serve in rural areas.
So you can't ask for better outcomes than that.
Right. The state is also interested in this, and the state provided some funding for us this year to expand that Kenan program. And we decided to adjust it just a bit to incentivize service directly to our state, since it's state dollars that are being used. And we developed the North Carolina Rural Promise Scholarship, which is some debt reduction for our medical students who commit to serving in North Carolina.
And so then that is tied to them actually following through in service in our state.
Correct. If they chose to practice medicine in another state, they'd have to repay those scholarship dollars.
Okay. And along with those various programs, the big emphasis with the new curriculum is also on some individualization is the term that's used a lot. Tell us a little bit about what that means and what does that mean for students?
Right. So at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, we have a very broad mission. We certainly want to produce the primary care physicians that our state needs, but we also want to produce subspecialists that are needed to care for the population of North Carolina. And we want to inspire some of our students into a career focused in discovery and research. We do all this with our commitment to the public service, as our mission is to be the nation's leading public medical school, with emphasis on that public service. So with our broad mission, we want to provide a flexible curriculum that will allow our students to find their way where they're going to use their skills and talents to make the most significant impact. So what we've tried to do is distill down what every future doctor needs to know, condense that as much as possible, and then allow lots of enrichment opportunities for each and every individual student as he or she heads down their own path.
Dr. Bailey, I know you've been a residency director for a few years, and you appreciated getting well-trained medical students to your residency who were ready to hit the bricks the minute they stepped in the door.
Absolutely.
And I also know that everybody's thorn around here lately has been this electronic medical record that we're using, and can the students do this and that? And usually the answer is yes. But then can they really write notes, discharge summaries, all this kind of stuff in the record? Because there's Medicare rules that prohibit that at some level. I wonder if you'd make some comments on that.
Sure. So as we prepare physicians to practice in modern healthcare, we want our students to become skilled at using the technology that is available to them. And we want them to do that in a way that's patient-centered. I know that most of us have had the experience of seeing a physician who has to document in the computer and sometimes maybe even turns his or her back to us, the patient, while they're doing that documentation. We're teaching today's medical students how to utilize the computer, the electronic health record, but engage the patient at the same time. And since today's students have grown up with this technology, it comes easily to them. So we're trying to make our students very effective and efficient using electronic health records where they can maintain a focus on the patient, him or herself, not the computer.
And most of those students of this generation have grown up around technology in a much different way than I would imagine many of the faculty have grown up around technology. How do you navigate some of the generational differences in medical education?
Well, it's a way that we make our students valuable. The students are valuable to their more senior faculty in helping them with their technical skills, for sure. But we're educating our students using lots of resources, like you might assume. For example, all the students in the pediatrics clerkship are given an iPad. And on that iPad, not only do they have their curricular materials, but they also have materials that they utilize for patient education, videos, for example, about procedures that a child might need, images, graphics that are helpful in communication with patients and families. I think this is the way modern healthcare will be delivered, using technical resources to benefit patients.
Now, we would be remiss if we didn't come back to talk a little bit about you before we go into the future. But you are a practicing pediatrician, a mother, a wife, you wear multiple hats. How do you balance all that, Dr. Byerly?
Balance is a hard word.
You wish it was a checky box?
That's right.
We would get it.
But I do think that working in pediatrics and for the purpose of medical education, you know, I feel good about what I'm trying to do with my whole life. I'm trying to use the opportunities I've had and the gifts I've been given to make the world a better place for children, my children, the world's children, medical students that I sometimes see as mature children, and trying to provide for them opportunities of how they can contribute to make the health of populations better.
And so then as you're reflecting on that purpose and the grace with which you follow through with that purpose, and yet you have multiple pressures and elements to balance in forward leadership for a complicated medical school that now has multiple campuses, growing number of students, how do you really go back to set those goals and be sure you're remaining true to yourself?
The University of North Carolina School of Medicine is by and for the people of North Carolina. So if in our work we are doing things to benefit North Carolinians, then that's the direction we need to head. I think we need to celebrate the diversity of our state, educate a diverse student body to meet the needs of a diverse population. That feels true to our mission and purpose and is something we're working hard on. Providing a flexible curriculum is also true to our mission, again, meeting the needs of our population.
So looking forward a while, 5 years maybe, what do you think are the next steps that need to happen once you get tech implemented and running?
We need to fully utilize our regional campus system. We're so fortunate at the University of North Carolina to have clinical campuses in Asheville and Charlotte. We also have a new clinical campus opening in Wilmington, and we use a lot of clinical teaching sites in Greensboro and Raleigh as well. I hope that there'll be opportunities to expand those clinical campuses and take advantage of the state's resources as we provide physicians across the state.
Gosh, Dr. Byerly, thank you for taking this time with us today, but especially for your leadership of our medical school and the contributions that you are making through the school in our state.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and it's a real pleasure to get to work with you all.
We've been talking with Dr. Julie Byerly, Vice Dean for Education at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, about training physicians for the 21st century. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Bob and I will get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like for us to answer on the show, please send us your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question.
I'm headed to Mexico in about 2 days. I've heard about this Zika virus, and I wonder what I can do to avoid it.
Well, there's a lot of information out there. It's on the news, and it's certainly concerning. You're smart to be thinking about it. You know, as you've probably heard, it's spread through mosquito bites. So you want to think about ways to avoid mosquito bites. You know, wearing bug spray, especially that bug spray that has DEET in it, is effective. Also thinking about wearing long sleeves and just trying to avoid mosquito bites the best you can.
Yeah, and I just emphasize that this apparently has changed, the virus has, because it got discovered in the 1940s, and it hasn't been that prevalent or that seemed to cause that much disease until lately. So there's probably been some sort of mutation of the virus that leads to microcephaly in pregnant women's children, or infants.
So explain what that means.
It means a disproportionately small head with malformations of the brain. Mm-hmm. And also can lead to a syndrome called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a nerve and muscle problem. So it's worth paying attention to, for sure.
It is. I mean, it is, thankfully, still extremely rare. So it's worth finding out and thinking about exactly where you're traveling to and what kind of outbreaks are happening there and doing the very best you can to avoid mosquito bites. All right, let's take our next house call question, Daniel.
My 14-year-old daughter started having menstrual periods about 6 months ago. They've never been predictable and are always a surprise when they start. Is there anything we can do about that?
Well, menstrual periods are irregular in almost every woman who starts them as a teenager. And that's because they generally don't ovulate early on in their mature life. So the thing that sets the timer on periods is ovulation, and they won't get regular until she starts to ovulate unless you were to intervene. And some people with very heavy periods have used birth control pills to take over the normal function of the menstrual cycle, and it makes it regular, and you can make it a small amount.
Yeah, for most teenagers, as they're first getting their periods, like you're saying, Bob, they're not going to be regular, and it's really, really common for them to be spaced out and unpredictable like that. So a lot of teenagers and parents just need to hear that that is normal and that that is sort of part of how things happen. And yeah, a lot of people do want to take birth control pills to both add predictability, but and also if when they come, they're really, really bad. And sometimes those pills can help just regulate the cycle and make it a little bit less stressful. So good luck, but do talk with your doctor about that to see if there are any nuances in your child's situation. All right, Daniel, what do we have next?
I've heard about teenagers dying because of opioid painkillers. How can I protect my son against this?
Ooh, that's a different twist of thinking about how to protect your son. These painkillers, and these are, I mean, you hear about morphine, Percocet, hydrocodone, hydromorphone, Vicodin, all the different trade and generic names, but they are extremely common just in the general population, and there have been a lot of deaths related to it, but it's also become something that a lot of teenagers will sort of pop either to mix in with other drugs or to relieve pain or just to have fun. The first thing you could do to protect a child is to make sure you don't have those kind of painkillers laying around or available in your own house, in your own closet. So thinking about protecting those if you do have those in the house from any temptation. And then talking to your kids.
And it's particularly important to talk to them about this because this has become the leading cause of adolescent death in North Carolina. I also would add that there are a couple of things that are problematic besides the opioids. Number one is that it is a respiratory depressant, makes you slow down your breathing. So does alcohol. So do other drugs like Valium. And the combination of those things can kill.
So it's wise that you're paying attention and great that you asked the question. Hopefully that will alert some other parents as well. Okay, Daniel.
I think I broke my left big toe when I banged it into a leg on my couch. What can I do about that?
Well,
ouch.
You can try to first examine it and see that it's well aligned. If it's not well aligned, you're going to need to see a doctor about it. But most of the people that do that, it's not that badly aligned. And then what you need to do is find a walking boot or some sort of a splint that'll help you walk without moving it any more than possible. Ice initially is a very good thing to use. And, you know.
And sometimes if you've broken that little toe or if you've damaged that toe, you can buddy tape it or tape it to the toe right beside it. And a lot of times you can just get that tape at CVS or at any pharmacy and that allows the other toe to really support that toe as it's healing. It can take a while to heal, just a heads up, but do try to protect it from further injury as you go. Sorry you got hurt. Thanks for joining us today. For your health, we hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and to your health. We want you to share your questions, share your stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. That's your health, one word. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Get our health app. Lots of different ways to be with us.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, and our guest today, Dr. Julie Byerly, Executive Education Dean at UNC School of Medicine. We hope that you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And we look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.